Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Most smartphone or tablet users know the excitement of buying a new phone or downloading the new app everyone is talking about, but that excitement doesn't always last. Eventually, maybe after just a few days, maybe for as long as a few weeks, the novelty begins to fade. There's a term for that. Joining us now is the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better, technology journalist Clive Thompson. Welcome to the show, Clive.
Hi there. Good to be here.
You wrote about the novelty effect and technology, but the novelty effect, it's not necessarily a new idea, right?
Yeah, it goes back some time. Social scientists started noticing this back earlier in the century when they found things like this at the Hawthorne Electric Factory, that the people who ran it, they wanted to find out, you know, if they reduced the lighting in the factory, if they increased the lighting in the factory, would people be more productive and more effective? So they tried both. But it turns out that no matter what they did, people still became temporarily more productive. It seems that merely changing your environment and making it kind of seem new and fresh is enough to make people work a little harder or be a little more creative or a little more productive. That's since been talked about as the novelty effect.
And when it comes to the technology that is growing on us in the last 20 years, and particularly in the last 5 to 10 years, it's coming at a much faster pace. There's more and more things that are novel to us.
That's right, exactly. Like it's a lot easier now to have kind of a strange, interesting new way of experiencing the world. You know, like I think about Instagram. You know, that came along 4 years ago, and a bunch of my friends they'd never really been picture takers. You know, they didn't think very visually, but having Instagram in their pocket, which gave them a little audience for their pictures, and gave them these kind of little quite beautiful filters to make that you could take a picture and see it in a new way, bring out new details you didn't see before. This really triggered the novelty effect, and you could see them sort of explode in creativity and the amount of photos they took. They suddenly took way more photos, and they took genuinely better photos than I had ever seen them take for a long time. But you know, over time, and for some people it took a few weeks, some people it took a few months, a lot of them drifted away. It stopped being new. It stopped feeling fresh. And once it stopped feeling fresh, the catalytic power of the experience went away. This wasn't true for everyone. There are still, I mean, I'm still actually an Instagram user, and some of my friends still are. But the bulk of them had that little brief boost of creativity that went away.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with technology journalist Clive Thompson. He's author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. And he's recently written about the idea of the novelty effect and technology. So, yeah, Instagram's a great example, but this is happening constantly almost now.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, you can think of almost anything that comes along, some funny little app that lets you chat in a new way, and people pick it up and try it for a little while, and you know, sometimes the thrill lasts, you know, half an hour.
Right.
and so sometimes it lasts longer. One of the things that interests me is whether it's possible for any technology ever to fight this in the long run, right? Because you take a look at Facebook. So Facebook started off being this very, very new experience, this idea that you could broadcast little bits of what was happening to you all day long to your friends. And so they could see that stuff, and they could have this sort of joint awareness that was really quite pleasant. So, that's a big change to people's environment. And a lot of people found it very energizing, you know, socially, emotionally, creatively, whatever. But, you know, over time, you know, it starts to become not as new, and people start drifting away. So if you look at Facebook, they have responded over and over again by changing the way they work, by stealing ideas from other services, by adopting things, by flat out buying companies. Mm-hmm. They constantly change in an attempt to keep Facebook seeming fresh and new. But my suspicion is it's probably in the long run a failed it's doomed to failure in the long run. You can do this for some years, but you see a lot of people they regard Facebook now as sort of a chore. It feels like something they have to do, to stay on top of things. But it doesn't bring any joy or delight anymore. The novelty is completely gone.
Yes, and that creates this the more we have novelty, the more we want. It's an amazing churn.
Yeah, it is. Although, keep in mind, I'm not entirely negative about it. I think you can actually use it actively to sort of have fun. Because on the one hand, you could look at this and say, well, this is sort of like consumption. This is more like consumer culture writ large. The fact that we're,
the throwaway generation. Yeah,
new and improved. Walk in and the soap is basically exactly the same soap as it was, a year ago, but they said new and improved. So like, oh, let's give it a try. And so advertisers have long known that, appeals to novelty can trigger us. So that's clearly, I think, a bad thing when it comes to amassing, stuff you don't need. But when it comes to just sort of, having a fun little experience for like a week or something on some new app or tool, I see not only no harm in this, I see actually benefits in this if you use it to your advantage. Here's an example. So towards the end of working on my book, I'd started using this word processor called Scrivener, and I'd written most of my book in it. I'd spent 2 years sitting down every day at Scrivener. And when time came to edit it, I had to change what I'd written. I had trouble looking at it and seeing it with fresh eyes. So I pulled out a laptop of mine that was like about 7 years old with some decrepit old version of Microsoft Word on it. And I used that to do the editing. And because everything looked different, it was on a different machine, in different fonts, in a different word processor, it sort of triggered the novelty effect in me. Everything looked new and strange again, and I found that I had much more energy. It sort of alienated the experience for me. I could look at it with fresh eyes, and I just burst into editing. So I actually think it's possible to actively use the novelty effect and say, I need to change my mental environment. So I'm going to use a different tool, a different environment. And sometimes that can even be like, I find this like, I'm going to work on just pencil and paper for the next half day on this project because I need to get away. I need a different mental environment from staring at my screen. So in one sense, a novelty effect can be, you can sort of use it to hack your attention and your creativity and your productivity.
Well, I mean, all you can do is go back and look at old photographs from the 60s and 70s and say, hey, it's like Instagram.
Exactly. Or writers who've always said, a change of environment seems to trigger something, right? I mean, whether that's, like taking your notebook, your laptop and going working in a cafe or something. I can't tell you the amount of people I know in advertising and marketing and law. When they need to get a bunch of work done, they somehow find they can't get it done at their desk because they sit at their desk 40 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And so they grab, this is one of the reasons you see all those people in Starbucks. They're there to just sort of somehow trigger the environment to be a little fresh and new. And there's something about that that tips them over into being able to concentrate again. This is a great paradox. To concentrate, we move to an area with lots of noise and music and distraction. But because novelty has its effect on us, it works. I've done this myself. I work from home in my bedroom, which is about as dull and repetitive an environment as you can possibly imagine. So whenever I need to get a bunch of work done, you'll find me sort of rotate. Like I not only go to a cafe, I get weary of that cafe after 3 or 4 days and I move to another one. So you'll see me sort of rotating like a planet around the solar system of my neighborhood, constantly seeking novelty in an attempt to stimulate my creativity.
Is this a function of the age we live in and the technology that we work with?
Well, put it this way. I think it's a function. Novelty is, from what I understand, having read a little bit of the psychology of it, is very deeply baked into our psychology, even down to like the neural level. Like, for example, your eye, when you look at the world around you, your eye and your brain are essentially really, when you stare at something that doesn't change, you stop noticing the stuff that does. You only pay attention to the stuff that does change. Mm-hmm. And this is how a lot of magic tricks work. This is why we're able to pull certain illusions. So some of the fact that we don't pay attention to things that are not new is very deeply baked into our psychology. But that said, we now live in an environment where there are so many more opportunities for newness that I think the novelty effect is being triggered over and over again way more rapidly than it ever was in the past. And people, for good and for ill, right? I mean, there's a downside to our novelty-seeking behavior, even in these experiences. I think that some people, I think it can sort of remove some of your stick-to-itiveness, your grit, if you're constantly seeking a novel environment. I mean, I know musicians, for example. I'm an amateur musician, and they'll often find, okay, they buy a new guitar, they buy a new new recording rig or something, and it sort of gives them this temporary, you know, sense of fun and exploration. They write a bunch more music, and that's a great thing. But you know, there's also something to be said for just forcing yourself to sit down and be creative without needing any external stimulus, right? So I think although it can be used as an aid, it can also become a crutch if you don't watch it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Clive Thompson. He has written about the novelty effect in technology. It's not a new idea, but it's being applied in new ways every day, every minute of your life, these seems like. If you have a question or comment for Clive, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Is this novelty effect that we're having and we're nurturing with the changing technology in our lives affecting, you mentioned that you aren't necessarily endorsing conspicuous consumption of things, but is it part of the problem of it is that our brains are stimulated by all these different apps and all this different technology that, relatively speaking, doesn't necessarily cost that much money if you just change apps every couple days.
Yeah.
But do we also want to go out and like have to have a new phone every year or two?
Oh my goodness! Absolutely, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, the phone novelty in the hardware is huge. You see, people. I think I haven't really looked into these statistics recently, but a lot of people swap phones like every year, pretty much. You know, they get a new one, and there is a mountain of extremely toxic waste being produced by this.
Right.
And so, I mean, I've long argued, and other people in the environmental movement have long argued that, you know, either we have to take away or we have to mitigate our craving for novelty in the hardware, or we have to figure out how to recycle these things, maybe a little bit of both. You know, right now, people will go out and, like, you know, think nothing of grabbing a new phone and hurling the other one in the garbage. And even if you send it to somewhere recycling, it produces a lot of waste.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could also argue, and I think this is completely true, that, you know, the online world, there's a blurring between experiencing something that's just a fun thing, like a piece of culture, like a story or a blog post or whatever, and that doesn't do any harm at all, except maybe your productivity if you're, you know, wasting time going through Wikipedia entries of old Doctor Who episodes instead of getting work done. Not that I would say I've done that.
But there's a lot of
consumption that happens online now. And I mean, I know a lot of people that, you know, buy stuff they probably don't need because they're sort of just poking around on eBay or Etsy or whatnot. And it's gotten a lot easier to engage in novelty for physical stuff and cruft and acquisition because, you know, shopping is basically now sitting at your computer. And, oh, look at this lovely blog that, you know, that showed me this cool new guitar pedal that, oh, I suddenly need, you know. So it's a dangerously tempting environment, novelty wise. And I think the other thing, you know, let's get away from talking about buying, you know, stuff. Let's just talk about the potential dangers of our novelty seeking, even in information. This is really what's behind people sort of vanishing into a Twitter hole for 3 hours, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're sitting at your white collar job at your desk, and it's not terribly interesting. And so your brain goes, well, maybe there's something more interesting and more novel happening on Twitter. Well, of course there is. It's a roiling sea of interesting stuff. People constantly, you know, throwing up an interesting article they read or a picture or an observation. People always say that, you know, Twitter is nothing but, you know, crap. But I think it's almost the opposite problem. It's too interesting. There's too many interesting things going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always going to be more interesting and more novel and more new than what is sitting at your desk, the spreadsheet that you're trying to finish doing and the report you're trying to finish writing, or in my case, the story you're trying to finish writing. And it requires, you know, the willpower of a Buddhist monk to be able to resist that on a regular daily basis. That to me is a clear and present problem with our novelty seeking behavior.
Mike in Dublin, you're on the air with Clive Thompson. Hi, Mike.
Hey, I just have a comment to make. The novelty principle has a similar thing in the gaming world called curves of interest. These, you find people playing games for years, because when you get to different levels, all of a sudden new capabilities are available that you didn't have before, and the game is suddenly interesting again, or you suddenly try something a different way and find yourself opening up a new world to explore that you didn't have before when you played it, you know, 5, 6, 7 times. So this novelty principle, you know, everywhere.
Thanks a lot, Mike. That's a great point as far as the gaming industry goes.
I think he is spot on. And in fact, actually, years ago, I wrote about this in a Wired column without having a term for the phrase yet. I didn't actually know this concept. But I was describing exactly what that caller was just saying, which is because I've been a gamer for a long time. And I was pondering, what was the moment when I suddenly stopped playing a game? Because often I would start playing a game and I would get swept up in it. And it would be like just being held in the talons of some beast that will not let me go. and I literally could not stop playing. But then suddenly, you know, those talons would let me go. Like I would boot the game up, very eager to play it. And I would sort of go, huh, it's not keeping my attention anymore. And I talked to friends about it and they all reported the same thing. And they would say, well, it's because you probably exhausted the limits of what's new about it, right? And the thing that this gentleman called about is what is the response of a lot of these game makers, the ones where you pay $15 a month to play like World of Warcraft or something. Mm-hmm. Those folks really want to keep you playing. They want never to have you feel yourself turning away because it stops being fresh and new. And so hence these expansion packs, these new levels, like it used to be that, you know, level 40 or 50 was the top level for as high as you could go in World of Warcraft. Well, now it's up to 90, and they just keep on, every time they get there and people start getting weary, they're like, well, we're going to open up a new area. It's fiendishly brilliant, you know, understanding of our psychology, because I personally actually have about 6 years ago, I realized I had to stop playing World of Warcraft for exactly that reason, because I am too much of a sucker for novelty. And I would sit there at my desk ignoring, you know, work, family, children, community. Yeah. And so now I just, you know, I
just write about it.
From friends of mine. yeah. I hear my friends, we had this wonderful raid. I'm like, tell me about it, because I'll never know myself. I cannot be trusted in that environment.
Clive Thompson, I said, you know what you know what they always say about writers is write about what you know. You have been doing it very well. Clive Thompson, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, I had fun. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Clive Thompson, he's a technology journalist and author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for Better. Speaking of gaming, coming up later on in Tech Tuesday, we're going to talk about what's new at the Electronics Entertainment Expo, or E3. But when we return, we're going to do some laundry. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Laundry. Some love the job, some don't. For many, it's the lugging it to the laundromat part that is most irksome. Same with the dry cleaning. There are delivery services, but they can be cumbersome too. You have to drag it somewhere. There's a startup for that. New smartphone apps are available in some regions that ease the aggravation of those tasks. Joining us to talk about the implication of all of this is Jessica Pressler, whose piece on Silicon Valley's laundry startups recently appeared in New York Magazine. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, before we get to the apps themselves, tell us what motivated these entrepreneurs to get into these startups.
Well, I think it's like you said. I mean, basically, they looked around and they were looking for things that, you know, could be made simpler. You know, everybody right now is kind of looking to become the Uber of something, looking to make, you know, a lot of money by just kind of simplifying a piece of everyday life. And, you know, laundry is a piece of people's lives that, you know, could be a lot simpler, they thought.
many tech startups are interested in disrupting an existing yeah. service or industry. Can you explain that term and how it's being used, say, in this case, or how it maybe take something more familiar to us and tell us how, and give us an example?
I think disrupting is, to use Uber as an example, it's to kind of shake up the status quo. You know, we all accepted in New York City or anywhere else the taxi industry just kind of as a fact of life. You have to hail them. They go on break between like 4 and 6 when you really need them. and, you know, stuff like that. And disrupting is kind of just Uber coming in and being like, you can get a car. It will come to you. You just click a button on your phone and it will drive up to you and pick you up. And, you know, it's a seamless transaction. You don't have to use a credit card. You don't have to like fumble with cash. It's just kind of makes things a lot easier. So that's what disrupting is basically an existing industry, just kind of going in there and shaking it up and making things different, easier for the consumer.
I get the Uber. I was surprised when I was reading about the ability to disrupt the laundry service industry. And I really enjoyed the part in the article where these guys are at this laundry convention.
Yeah, I really wish I had been there, actually.
I know it.
Every 2 years, there's something called the annual clean show, which is basically like, you know, every industry has its conventions. Mm-hmm. You know, we have our ridiculous media conventions, and this is, you know, a thing where people get together and there are booths where they sell, you know, tickets and detergent and, you know, all of the professional accoutrements that one needs to be a dry cleaner or a laundry service person. And then this year, it so happened that a few of these kind of younger, you know, well-educated kids, you know, kind of came down to New Orleans and were checking it out to be like, you know, is this industry as behind as we think it is? And they kind of looked around and didn't see anybody doing anything with technology. And they thought that that would be a good way in and was a good sign as far as their business being able to disrupt the industry.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Jessica Pressler. She's a writer for New York Magazine, and her piece on Silicon Valley's laundry startups recently appeared there. We'll have a link to it on our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. One of the companies you focused on in your piece was Washio.
Yeah.
They're the guys that were at that convention, came to the conclusion that they wanted to get into the laundry space, but they didn't want to do the laundry. They don't see themselves in that role.
No. It's kind of funny because these guys all get into the laundry business because they specifically don't want to do laundry. So the idea of actually doing it themselves. So no, they all, for the most part, I think it's safe to say that they all outsource the laundry mm-hmm. to these kind of mid-sized facilities that take care of hotel laundry and things like that. I think they do plan on eventually opening up their own laundromats, although ostensibly by that time the founders will be, you know, living in castles in Silicon Valley and definitely not doing their own laundry.
Yeah, these guys are classic entrepreneurs. If you got the tone right on them, they're just looking for a way to make the next million.
Yeah, it's really admirable, actually. I mean, to see kind of these young people, I mean, the Washio guys in particular had, after college, gone down to Argentina and started a chain of burrito stores. You know, they were like 22, and they started a chain of burrito restaurants. So they're very entrepreneurial. They're very focused. And Washio, in fact, yesterday announced that they raised $10 million. So they now have $10 million with which to expand their laundry empire.
And they had to, it sounded like a Harry Potter story when she tried to sell that book to a million publishing houses and finally one bit, but they tried for a long time to get backing.
Right, because it's a difficult industry to crack, actually, and what they're proposing is difficult. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts. You have to find in every city the place that's going to do the laundry. You have to find the drivers. You have to, you know, kind of make your brand consistent across all of these markets. It's a big challenge. And I think people, you know, kind of were like, oh, the the cost benefit isn't really, you know, worth it, except for it is if you really are going to take over. You know, if you're going to become a huge chain, then the numbers do add up.
Let's talk about the apps themselves. What does the Washio app do?
Well, basically, you can just kind of go in. You pick a time that you get your laundry picked up. You say what you need. And then a ninja comes over to your house and picks up your laundry for you. And then you can also schedule a time for it to be dropped off, and they return it to you. They can do it within 24 hours, which is another thing that makes them different from the
traditional
mm-hmm. laundry industry. And they also give you a cookie.
Yeah, I like the cookie idea.
In the beginning, it was a warm cookie, but I think that was logistically a little bit too complicated.
But it did pick up on the app out there that does deliver warm cookies in the middle of the night.
There is a competitor in New York, Fly Cleaners, that is doing the same kind of thing on the East Coast. They have a laundry app, and the owner owns a company called Insomnia Cookies
right.
that does deliver warm cookies in the middle of the night. So if they decide to start doing that, they could face some competition on the cookie front in a big way.
These services are only in a handful of cities, but can you give us an idea of how much competition is out there? A lot of it has to do with transportation. You know, most people say, a lot of people in Columbus, they still get in their car and drive places, but in New York or you know, a lot of big cities, they don't have that.
Yeah, I think every city is different. New York is a very different city. We've always had laundry pickup and delivery. We never had it really on demand the way that Fly Cleaners is doing it, where you can just press a button on your phone and it comes to you. They're like, you know, in your neighborhood already in a van. And in Los Angeles, you know, I think people, the traffic and stuff like that is a turnoff. You know, people get home from work. They don't want to go out again and do another errand. It's definitely an urban phenomenon at this point.
So is there much competition out there?
There's at least, I mean, I felt like every day I was hearing about a new one that was very similar. In every city, there's one of these. In Chicago, there's one called Drive. There's one in Dubai. There's one in Las Vegas that gives out cupcakes, which is really an edge. And yeah, there's at least 20, at least, that I know of.
Is there any other industry that's out there to tap, do you think, in this way?
Probably. I think you really have to just kind of drill down and think, like, what minor task in my life could be made easier, and perhaps you can make an app for that.
Yeah, that's sort of the way you start out. The article is talking about that, how this is a real first world problem trajectory
right.
we're talking about here.
It is, yeah. I mean, this is not something that a lot of people are really particularly, it's not first on their minds of problems that they need solved. But yeah, it does make life moderately easier if you can afford it.
Do you expect these guys that tapped into this laundry question to go into other kinds of businesses?
I think that might be the goal in the end. Once they've kind of established a whole logistical framework for delivery and pickup of things, I think that there's definitely, you know, an idea of making it, you know, more Amazon-like even to get that grandiose.
And I don't want to denigrate any delivery person by suggesting anything, by comparing the ninjas to anything else, but the ninjas are a little different. They're not like driving up in a beat-up old junker, making extra money on the side.
The ninjas are, I mean, it's kind of a relatively new phenomenon in our economy that there are all of these people who are kind of doing these tasks, like TaskRabbit. You can kind of make your own job. So a lot of them in Los Angeles were actors, they were artists, one of them was a dancer that I rode around with, and this was just kind of a way that they made extra money on the side. They could make their own hours, it was flexible, it was relatively painless. So it's really a lot of a way that people are making money now, kind of incrementally through these jobs.
And they're pleasant looking. They drive decent cars.
So far as I know, yeah. I mean, that's
the
goal.
Idea. Yeah,
yeah, that's the idea. They want like a kind of branded look to their people, I think.
You made the point of noting, at least in the LA operation, that the laundry that was operating was employed mostly immigrants who were not invited to the, you know, beer, craft beer parties and employee, you know, get-togethers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of a, that it's outsourced. That's like not really considered a part of the Washio company. They're not ninjas. They're just people who do the washing.
Did you ask them about complaints when they wreck your favorite coat? No bitterness here.
Oh, no. Yeah. All of these companies are very adamant that they are the best in customer service. A lot of them started because they were inspired by the dry cleaner wrecking their favorite coat or, like, you know, destroying a button or something like that. So they're all very flexible in the way that Amazon is with, you know, solving customer service complaints, which is another way that differentiates them from the traditional industry.
Okay. Well, Jessica Pressler, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
Jessica Pressler, her piece on Silicon Valley's laundry startups recently appeared in New York Magazine. We have a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And coming up, gaming innovations with Russell Holly from Geek.com. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Electronics Entertainment Expo, or E3, the video game industry's biggest and most anticipated event, is underway this week in Manhattan. This is where most new releases and new products make their debut before the likes of Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Russell checked it out yesterday. He joins us now. As always, welcome to the show, Russell.
Hey, it's Los Angeles, by the way.
Oh, it's Los Angeles. Okay, wow.
Yep.
That's weird. Okay. Well, L.A. Were you in L.A.?
I was not. I'm actually at home. But the cool thing about E3 now is that Sony and Microsoft and EA and Ubisoft, they've all got their cameras pointed towards the internet now. So a lot of these presentations we can watch remotely.
Why is the E3 Expo or E3 such a big deal?
Well, it ends up being just kind of the launch pad for a lot of the stuff that happens throughout the year. It's a good place for these companies to get together and say, this is what our roadmap is for the next couple of months. And it gets people excited and in some cases allows them to launch hardware. This year, we're probably not going to see too much hardware because Sony and Microsoft have already launched consoles. And Nintendo is kind of still struggling along with the Wii U, but their presentation is actually in about 25 minutes. So they may have something interesting.
Microsoft made a presentation yesterday and announced news about the popular combat game Halo. What can gamers look forward to? What was the big deal?
There was a ton of stuff that happened with Halo. The first thing they did was they announced they showed some additional video footage for Halo 5 Guardians, which is due out next year. But then they also made it clear that all four of the previous major Halo titles are going to be coming to the Xbox One in the form of a collector's edition that's going to have all of the games remastered in 1080p running at 60 frames a second and a ton of extra content surrounding that. So if you are a Halo fan, this is going to be a huge game just collection of content that's going to be coming out later this year.
We were talking about the novelty effect earlier in the program and how one of the callers made the point about what a big deal that is in the gaming industry, where they're always trying to find a new level, something new to give you to work with. Otherwise, you're going to get bored.
That's a big part of why multiplayer is such a big deal now, is that, you know, once you go through and you play the story mode, you go and you have a reason to play online and keep playing that game. And in some cases, multiplayer has become so important that games like Titanfall barely even have a story mode because the gameplay is so focused online that it just wasn't worth spending the resources, in the opinion of the guys making the game. I personally disagree, but I'm a big fan of story stuff.
The Microsoft presentation focused on software instead of hardware. In fact, the Kinect motion sensor that got a lot of attention when Xbox One came out, is that losing its interest?
They didn't mention it at all, which was particularly interesting because they just recently announced a bundle where you can, for $100 cheaper, purchase the Xbox One without the Kinect at all. The Kinect is a cool accessory. But it was kind of a mandatory part of the Xbox One, and it made it $100 more than the PlayStation 4 when the two consoles launched. So it caused a lot of concern, and I still think that it's a really interesting accessory to have, but making it so that it's a choice, I think, is a pretty big deal. But it was really telling that there was not a single Kinect game announced from Microsoft yesterday. Nothing that, you know, directly required the Kinect in order to do some really cool stuff was even remotely talked about.
How long does this go on, all week?
This is something where, yesterday, all the big press events happened, and then today there's a few more things, and then the whole rest of the event is going to the big booth that they have set up to actually try the games out and, you know, kind of get a feel for what these games are going to be like moving forward. So we're probably not going to see more news come from E3, but we'll see more kind of hands-on experiences with some of the stuff that Sony and Microsoft and their partners have come up with.
Sony also had a big presentation yesterday. It made news about a game streaming and device, a new PlayStation TV set-top box.
This is a surprisingly big deal because there's, you know, when it comes to people who play video games, there's people who are willing to spend $400 and $500 on a video game console that allows them to play games, and then there's everybody else. The PlayStation TV gives the ability to play PlayStation Vita games and stream games from the PlayStation Now service, which is kind of like a video game rental service for PlayStation 3 and previous generation games. And it's only going to be $99. You can plug it into any HDMI-capable television, and they're going to sell a $139 kit when it comes out later this year that will give you a DualShock 3 controller, a free game of your choosing, and the ability to connect it to the television. And that, I think, is a really big deal because PlayStation Now is going to be kind of this new thing that allows new consoles and portable consoles and even televisions that don't have anything hooked up to them at all, depending on how smart they are, play these PlayStation games for, you know, very inexpensive rental costs, like $2 all the way up to $20, I think, are the current rental costs that they're looking at. And, it doesn't require much in the way of additional hardware in order to play it. So I think it's going to end up being a pretty big deal.
Is there any question that streaming games is sort of the future of gaming?
I think that streaming games is a direction. I don't think it is the direction. I think that it's going to be a good avenue for people who want to play casual games. But at the end of the day, we are nowhere near the maximum for what these game designers can come up with as far as graphic realism and things like that. So as that technology continues to push forward, we will still need more complex hardware to handle kind of local processing.
Okay.
But for a lot of these other games, especially previous generation games, services like NVIDIA's GameStream and the PlayStation Now service will be able to handle that stuff remotely. So I think in a way it's kind of creating two classes of video gamers. We'll have kind of the casual gamer and the more hardcore gamer. I think that those classes will become more defined in the future.
I was watching a little bit of that This Is the End movie with Seth Rogen, that movie, and I was last night, and they were making a big, just at the beginning of the movie, they talk about the 3D gaming. Is that ever taken off?
Not really.
Yeah.
3D gaming is one of those things where, if you're willing to spend the money, it's kind of cool, but it's really terribly expensive, and I've never really felt like it was worth it personally.
Yeah, just not that good. You mentioned that Nintendo has set up demo stations at some stores so gamers can preview new games. Is that new?
That is something that they did last year. They didn't do an E3 presentation at all last year. They just said, instead of us standing up on stage talking, you could just go to Best Buy and try these games out. And that was really cool. But this year, they are also doing an E3 presentation. But games like Super Smash Brothers for the Wii U are going to be at select Best Buy stores starting tomorrow, I think. Or no, Thursday, starting Thursday. And you can go to Best Buy's website and go pull up the store locator. It will tell you which stores in your area will have these demo stations. The way that they handled it last year, you showed up, you got your name on a list, and you were given, you know, basically three lives for whatever the games were. And once you were done, you got, you know, pushed out, and the next person got to take a spot. It's a cool setup, but it's very temporary.
They can't have someone sitting there for 12 hours, right?
Which is unfair. I really think that I should sit there for 12 hours.
Because that's the way you do it.
Exactly.
Are any other companies, Microsoft or Sony or anything like that, trying that out?
No, this is something that Nintendo started last year, and so far they're the only ones to do it.
You know, it seems like a pretty obvious thing to do.
It definitely seems like an obvious thing to do, but it requires a lot of setup, especially with Best Buy, because they essentially have this game. They have this one disc with, you know, all these games that don't exist yet.
Okay.
And it kind of has to be, like, kept under lock and key, because if that disc disappears, then chaos will ensue.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com, about what's new at the E3 Expo in Los Angeles. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us if you do it. Get snappy at allsides@wosu.org. It seems like Nintendo is falling a little bit behind when it comes to competing with the other game companies. Was that a visible concern at the expo?
Yes, Nintendo is falling a lot of bit behind. They have already sold less versions of the Wii U than Microsoft and Sony have sold of their new consoles that have only been out for a couple of months. And the Wii U has been out for well over a year already. So they are absolutely falling behind when it comes to, you know, kind of hardware that's in the area. And they may do something today to address that. I doubt that it's going to be, you know, making any concessions on price or anything like that. But, you know, they're going to keep trying to, you know, push content that people are going to want to play. They made a lot of really interesting, you know, friends recently with the release of Mario Kart 8, and Super Smash Brothers is going to be another big game for them that's going to sell consoles. But these are all kind of short-term things, and Nintendo really needs to announce kind of a long-term strategy in order to keep people interested, I think.
Before we move on, was there one video game preview that really impressed you or has so far?
Uncharted 4 was something that looked really, really good. I was very surprised at how they're you know, announcing that they're wrapping up that game. I've never been a huge fan of the Uncharted series, but that was definitely a big move on their part. And a lesser-known game that is going to show up on the Xbox One is called Ori and the Blind Forest, and that is O-R-I and the Blind Forest. You can look it up on YouTube. It just looks so well done, very artistic. And definitely a game that I'm looking forward to.
Let's take a quick call from Bob in Columbus. You're on the air with Russell Holley. Hi, Bob.
Hi, and thanks for taking the call.
You bet.
Russell, question about what's the best type of video screen, basically, that you want to get? You've got the OLEDs, you've got the LCDs, you've got all sorts of different types. Do you have any preference? Is there one better than the other, refresh rate and all that stuff?
I'm personally a fan of OLED screens for my laptop and for my desktop monitors. But the problem that we run into with televisions right now is that a lot of them are they're OLED backlights and not actual OLED panels, which is something that you have to be careful because it's very specifically worded. So I think that LCD panels are probably your best bang for your buck, typically from LG or from Samsung. But if you are not looking for kind of like the most money that you can spend, then Vizio, I think, makes really good panels as well.
Okay. Bob, thanks a lot for that call. And Mateus in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mateus.
Hi. Hey, I didn't get through. Hey, I was wondering about what do you think of the development of, like, Sony's, I think it's Morpheus virtual reality headset, and then that one that's on demo for it. I was just looking up on my phone. I couldn't remember what it was. But, yeah, I mean, I've been seeing a lot of videos of people playing, like, roller coaster games and freaking out about it. I was wondering, how far do you think this is going to be taken in the future?
Sure. So you're talking about Project Morpheus from Sony and the Oculus Rift headset, which is being developed more for PCs and stuff. And I think that both of them are very cool concepts. I've used the Oculus Rift a couple of times. I've not had a chance to use Project Morpheus yet. And the whole idea is that you put on this headset and your entire visual field is consumed by this display. And when you move your head around in the real world, it moves your head around in the game. And I think that that's very cool. And if they can keep the price down around $250, which is what it looks like both companies are doing, then it's going to open the door for some really cool things moving forward. But I don't know that I would pick one over the other, per se. Morpheus is going to be pretty much exclusively PlayStation, whereas it looks like Oculus Rift is going to be pretty exclusively PC for the time being. I guess, you know, it really depends on the hardware you have. If you have a really good computer, then obviously the Oculus Rift would be a pretty good investment to make once they are actually on shelves. And Sony didn't really say much of anything about Project Morpheus yesterday. They didn't bring it out on stage. They showed a picture of it and said, you know, we have these at the demo area, but it's clear that they're not quite ready to go yet.
Okay. Thanks, Mateus, for that call. You wanted to talk about the Amazon phone. It's been talked about. There's been... It's been in development for a while now. What's the deal?
We've heard whispers about this phone for so long now, and then Amazon did this really cool thing where they just put a block of images up on their website that linked to a video of these people kind of staring down ambiguously at nothing, saying, wow, this is really cool. This is, you know, kind of life-changing. And it looks like they are going to announce a new kind of smartphone that does some pretty cool tricks. But they did this form that anybody can fill out and get invited to the event in Seattle. So you can go to the Amazon website right now, and there's a form that you can fill out, and they will, if you get approved, they will invite you to their office in Seattle for the unveiling of this phone. It's something anybody can do, and hopefully anybody is me as well, because they've done some really cool things with the Fire TV and with the Kindle Fire tablet, and it's really looking like this could be a very cool new kind of smartphone.
And you haven't taken a trip in a while.
It has been, well, I mean, I go to New York every once in a while, but it's been a bit since I've been on the other side of the country.
Because they do everything remotely now.
I know.
Technology. So is it expected, do you think, it's going to be a real challenge to other cell phone makers like Samsung, Motorola, Apple?
Well, the cool thing that Amazon has that no one else has is a gigantic website that hundreds of thousands of people go to every day that they can plaster their own advertisements all over. So it's entirely possible that if they do something really cool, that they can use that as an opportunity to say, look how much better our phone is than everyone else. So yes, I think that even if they didn't release the best possible phone that they could, they have an impressive platform to advertise it from. And that is probably more important. But they have been working with a company that does really interesting facial recognition and facial tracking software stuff, where they take multiple cameras embedded in the front of, let's say, a phone. And when you tilt your head or when you move the phone, the image on the display, instead of being kind of a weird 3D panel that hurts your eyes, it actually uses the three-dimensional contours of your face to adjust the image to match. And while I've only ever seen that in demonstrations, having that built into an actual phone could be pretty cool.
And it runs off the Android operating system, right?
Amazon does everything based on Android, yeah. But not like what you would see on a Moto X or on a Nexus 5 or something like that. They have their own colors and apps and things like that. It's their own personal brand of Android that you see on the Kindle Fire and on the Amazon Fire TV. They all run Android, but it's very different and very targeted, and in a lot of cases, incredibly user-friendly. So I think that that's something that Amazon has done really well with the tablet and with the Fire TV, and hopefully will continue.
Russell Holly, thanks as always. We really appreciate it. Hope you have a great day.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Hope you've enjoyed Tech Tuesday today on all sides. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins. Video production is by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Couldn't do the show without them. Thanks to all. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.